Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 166 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. You can listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast using iTunes or another podcast program. You can also listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for long-distance charges. I'd love to hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. If you want to donate monthly, go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth, or you can send a one-time donation to david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com using PayPal, for example. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. A little bit of feedback from Sherry. I just listened to your podcast about the HPV vaccine. It was very good. I had no idea it would cause such horrible side effects. I had my twins vaccinated for HPV in 2007, and I feel terrible about it now. Both started having health problems not long after. The doctors said that they probably won't be able to have children. That news was hard to take at the time, but now it is just devastating to think about. I will feel terrible guilt forever if it can't be fixed. They have hypothyroidism and are on hormone therapy treatment. I spend the days looking for information in hopes it might help. I doubt that their doctor will even consider this new information. I have been letting other family members with children know about the horrible side effects of this vaccine. The crazy thing is that I always felt bad that the vaccine wasn't available for my oldest kids. Now I am relieved that I didn't do this to all 4 of them. I love your podcast, and I've downloaded the Podbean app. Now let's get to our long interview this week. I hope you enjoy it. Bob Spurko is one of the few guests who lives in the same city as me, Calgary. I learned about him because his website, bobspurko.ca, is one of the places people go to get accurate and detailed information on scrambles, a type of mountain hiking that I'll get Bob to define in a minute. My hiking friend Ron told me that I should read Bob's biography because it was very interesting. Ron knows I'm a bit skeptical of pharmaceutical approaches to many conditions, and he told me that Bob had suffered from schizophrenia, which had a big and negative impact on his life many years ago, but had decided not to go the pharmacological route, and eventually had left the symptoms, at least, of schizophrenia behind him. When I read the story, I also found it fascinating, and like many of these real-life testimonies, unique and with no simple answers. I've got a lot of questions about it, and Bob has been kind enough to agree to join me today. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
So, we don't normally talk about outdoors activities on my show, but you and I share a love of a sport called scrambling. So, can you describe how this is different from hiking and mountain climbing?
Yeah, scrambling is chiefly using your hands to get up rock. That differs from hiking, but unlike rock climbing, there are no aids to protect you usually. There's no rope. If you fall, you're injured or you're dead. And actually, there's every year in the Canadian Rockies, there's one or two fatalities, if not more. So it's a dangerous sport. It also differs from hiking in that usually, except for a popular peak, it's off trail. So there's a lot of route finding. It's easy to get lost in the mountains when you're going through the trees or going up through cliff bands. So there's a lot of challenge, not just in climbing, but finding your way to the top. And that's the goal of scrambling, is usually to reach a peak.
Yes, and yeah, I've experienced that myself. Generally, we do it without a map. We sort of have some vague instructions. We can see the mountain, and you know, reading the instructions maybe from your website or from one of the books or another website, you sort of know, okay, go to the right around this and then left here. But when you get on the mountain, of course, it's hard to see those things. So you just kind of feel your way up to the top.
Yeah, that's right. It's some people get lost, but nowadays a lot of people are using GPS, which I have mixed feelings about. When I first started scrambling, all you had was a compass, a map, and a brief printout from a scrambling book, and that was it.
Yes, yes.
And it was kind of nice. It was old school, but it was also easy to make mistakes. But nowadays, there is a reliance on GPS, which I have mixed feelings about. In one instance, I know one person followed my route up Mount Kidd Peak in Kananaskis. I did the trip in the summertime. He attempted it in winter conditions. He followed my trail exactly, I'm sure, but because it was under snow, he slipped and fell and had to be helicopter rescued. So there are dangers to following GPS tracks.
Right. I mean, it should be said that a lot of people get into car accidents on the way to the mountains or on the way around town. So there's nothing that is without risk. But I think most scramblers recognize that there is inherent danger, and so they try to stay within their capabilities and take precautions close to cliffs and avalanche dangers and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a fun and exciting sport, and it draws hundreds of people to climb peaks, and that's such a satisfying and rewarding experience to make it up to the top of the mountain and to look around in all directions. It certainly motivates me, and I can't help but wonder what it's like to stand on such and such a peak.
Yes, yes. And, of course, the experience is different because sometimes you get to the top and it's raining and it's cold and there's no sunshine, and all you want to do is, like, touch the top, turn around, and go back.
Yeah.
Other times you spend an hour sitting in the sun eating your lunch and sunbathing. So it can.
Yeah, or sleeping, as some do.
Yes, yes. So somebody told me a story last night when I was out that they got to the top and they had somebody who wasn't really very well prepared, and it was also hungover, and they fell asleep on the peak, and I guess everybody came down, and an hour later they realized this person wasn't with them. And somebody was going up, and they said, "Would you mind waking up the person who's sleeping on top of the mountain?"
So oh, that's funny.
Yes, come down. Okay, so, and before that, you did a lot of mountain biking. Do you still do that?
No, I gave that up. I actually started, became really active back in the 80s, and I was doing a lot of road biking up
right.
to, I did centuries, like 100 miles a day and
right.
more
mm-hmm,
often.
Mm-hmm.
And then mountain bikes, towards the end of the 1980s, mountain bikes made their first appearance.
Right.
And I took to it just like that. It's an exciting sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it, and I did it for years. But I was going out with guys and girls, that were 20 years younger than me. And by the time I was getting close to 50, I was struggling to keep up to them. And
right.
and that's why I switched to scrambling.
Okay, which is more solitary. I understand you normally go out with your wife when you go scrambling?
Yeah, that's true. And you can at an easier pace than mountain biking.
Right, you know each other's pace. I guess that's another thing about scrambling is usually it's groups of two or three or four, not usually a large group of people.
Yeah, preferably. And the other thing, too, that got me into, that really made it for me scrambling was the advent of digital cameras. It made it easy to take pictures, and unlike biking, which you can't really stop, you can stop anytime and take photos.
Yes, that's true. Although, as we've both discovered, if you're part of a larger group and you stop to take photos, you can have people standing around impatiently.
Yeah, and that's why you want to choose your partners carefully.
Yes, people who appreciate the pictures that they get later.
Yeah.
Anyway, if we go way back to a much earlier time in your life,
yeah.
You suffered from the opposite. You suffered from an inability to be active, lethargy, which was part of a constellation of symptoms, which were at one point diagnosed as schizophrenia.
Yeah, that's right. I probably should go back to the start of that when...
When did you first sort of realize something unusual and not so great was going on with your health?
Well, actually, it wasn't bad when it first happened. I was in my late teens, and I noticed the night sky changed. I noticed that when I stepped outside, all the stars looked extra bright, extra sharp, or something. I can't explain it. And all the lights and all the light that fell on object took a whole new surreal meaning. And it was just, it was a wonderful sight. I would step outside and I would be spellbound on the spectacle that I saw. What I didn't know is that I was starting to lose touch with reality. And that followed by a few other things, totally unrelated, which left me puzzled. But I didn't worry about the night sky. It was a beautiful thing. I saw no harm in it.
Right, right.
But the next thing that impacted me, and it has to do with schizophrenia, which it would be years before I would learn that I had that, was that I was near the top of my class in school studying math and sciences, and when I went to university, I suddenly became apathetic. I just didn't care about my studies, and I dropped out after 2 years, and I couldn't understand why. And that was followed by bouts of fatigue, where I would be tired for hours, if not days. And that, after that, things really changed.
In a negative way, like you dropped out of school. You said that you went to work as a milkman, and that ended because, I guess, people, the whole concept of milkman disappeared at some
point.
Yeah,
that's right. Well, convenience stores came in, and
right.
nobody wanted milk delivered anymore. So I moved, so I had my first, boy, there are so many wide schizophrenia, which I've heard is likened to taking LSD, is like you say, a constellation of
symptoms,
of effects. And one of the first ones I had was a head rush, and there's no drugs involved.
Maybe tried marijuana a couple times, but you don't drink alcohol and you hadn't taken any other drugs, so
yeah.
That's not an explanation for what was
going
on.
Yeah, yeah. So what had happened is I was on a date with a girl. I was walking in a mall, and we passed by this really unique looking store with chrome and glass and stuff. And I'd seen this store in Buffalo, but we were in Niagara Falls rather. And when I saw the store the second time in Niagara Falls, I became confused, and I thought either I'm back in Buffalo or this is another store. And I guess another hallmark of schizophrenia is confusion. So I had problems with time and space. So this confusion resulted in a warm rush up my spine that exploded in my head in euphoria, like super pleasure. It was like 100 times better than sex. And I actually dropped to my knees. It was
right.
I was just in so much ecstasy, and it took a moment. I was oblivious to everything, and all of a sudden I come to, and I'm kneeling on a mall floor standing beside my date. And I'm getting up thinking, I don't know what happened, but I have to somehow explain this to my date.
Right.
So,
I'm sure she was also totally confused about
what's
going on.
I don't know what it said, but the date did go off well, but I somehow covered it.
Right.
I wish I remember what I said.
Yes.
Then the next rush I had was even more peculiar, and it was months later. I was in Toronto now working for a linen company, a driver, and I dropped off these, I was picking up, rather, some soiled towels, and the girl at the desk was helping me, and she picked up this bag of towels, which were heavy because they're damp, and she strained, and yet she smiled. And this, her image, her conflicting image of smiling and straining just burnt into my mind. And it confused me, but not right away. It set something off. I can't explain it. But I drove away, and I pictured her face and then of its own accord, all in my mind, her face swirled, changed colors and swirled. And then I got the warm rush, and it exploded in my head in euphoria again. I mean, if I wasn't sitting down, I would have fallen to my knees for sure. But
like
instead,
the last time.
Yeah, exactly like the last time. But this time I could control it.
Right.
It was kind of scary. So I'm driving down the 401, which is the main thoroughway in Toronto.
It's a notoriously big and busy highway.
Yeah, six lanes, and I thought, wow, that was amazing. So I checked to make sure I didn't lose control of my truck.
Right.
And then I pictured her face again, and I got the same rush.
And
I kept on doing it.
Right, but you were aware, like part of you was aware that you were experiencing abnormal things, right? Like it,
absolutely. This was out of the ordinary. And well, actually, my all I cared about was getting that rush. It was such a hit.
Right.
I almost didn't care if I got killed. It was, and it's a wonder I didn't. But each episode, the effects diminished. So by the end of the day, I was getting just a little bit of a buzz.
Right, but the other side effects like fatigue and apathy.
Oh yeah, they were there. The night sky was still there. The apathy, the fatigue was there. And I also was getting, that was the last major head rush after that. But after that, I got minor head rushes. Like I would listen to music and it would set off a minor rush. Or I'd see a light display and it would set off a minor head rush.
Mm.
And after that, I moved to Vancouver and I started getting more confusion. Mm. I was actually driving and I got confused because I didn't recognize the streets. All of a sudden, I thought I was in Toronto. For some reason, I thought I was in Toronto, and I'm straining to recognize the streets. And I had to drive a couple of blocks looking for landmarks and stuff, and nothing made sense. And then I realized, I'm not in Toronto. I'm in Vancouver. How could I forget that?
Yes. I think the only time I had an experience like that was with severe jet lag, where I sort of woke up and didn't know what country I was in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess I traveled a lot.
that was maybe more understandable, and that went away after a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
So when were you actually diagnosed with schizophrenia then?
That took some time. I actually went to while I was in Vancouver, I went to a family physician, and I tried to explain. I didn't go into the head rushes, and I more explained my confusion and my lassitude. And he suggested it was anxiety and gave me sedatives. And I actually took a couple and I threw them away. And that's when I decided I did not want to take drugs. I was adamant. Drugs are not going to cure me. I needed something better.
So why did you decide not to take pharmaceutical drugs?
Because my mind was clear. There's nothing wrong with my mind. I knew the outside world was fine, and my mind was fine, but something was happening as the information was getting to my brain, and that was the problem.
Right.
These what they're called is antipsychotics.
Right.
And I didn't know at that time, but I didn't want to be sedated, and I didn't want to have an altered personality either.
Mm, and antipsychotics do have kind of a bad reputation. They're pretty potent drugs, for sure.
They actually have pretty extreme side effects. I mean, you can be sedated, altered personality, there's sleep disorders, there's diabetes, there's even a loss of your brain cortex.
And isn't tachycardia, that's like, uncontrollable jerks and things like that in your body?
There is movement disorders as well.
Right.
Yeah. And these can even become, these side effects can even become permanent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty scary to take these.
Right. So, but you didn't know all that at that time. You just felt that it wasn't right for you.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
When you were experiencing the worst symptoms of schizophrenia, did you ever feel like you could be endangering yourself or somebody else? Or were there times when, like you said, you were driving, having these experiences? Did you feel like you might have a traffic accident or something while you were sort of semi-hallucinating?
Yeah, certainly with the head rush, I was kind of concerned about that because it was a feeling to die for, but those head rushes stopped, and then other effects came into place after that that were certainly affected my life, but they weren't life-threatening to me, myself, or to others. And schizophrenics aren't known to be violent unless they're taking recreational drugs.
Yeah, for what you've described, that doesn't seem to be an issue, but just like the confusion, if you're driving or operating equipment, that could potentially be very dangerous.
Yeah, that's true. Unfortunately, I didn't have... Well, I have mixed feelings about, but I didn't get any more serious head rushes.
Right. So eventually you ended up in Calgary, the city you live now, although I think maybe you moved away and back again since then. But you started to work with an alternative doctor on megavitamin therapy. Mm-hmm. So who was this, and why did you decide to do this?
Yeah, I'll have to go back. I moved to Calgary, and I started to get more problems. I mean... The problems I had at night were starting to appear during the daytime, and I found like malls. I couldn't handle being in a mall because of all the lights and activity and stuff. I was overwhelmed, and even being in like a department store, I was overwhelmed, and I got really worried because now it's starting to shut down. I was starting to get blocked out of the world I was having trouble functioning, mm-hmm. and I got worried. So I was lucky to have someone recommend me a doctor, Dr. Stajan Warness.
Mm-hmm.
I was incredibly lucky because this is a doctor. He's a conventional doctor. He actually still practices, by the way, in Calgary.
Because this was the 1970s, right?
Yeah. I was at 1975, actually. And I was probably I wasn't at rock bottom. I was going to get worse, actually. But I did see Stajan as I came to call him, and he put me at ease. He never, ever mentioned taking drugs, and he put me on megavitamin therapy.
Right, but what you described was that after you started megavitamin therapy, your symptoms actually worsened before they got better. So I was wondering why you didn't just quit at that point. Why did you persist?
I wondered about that too. I was thinking back, it was supreme confidence on my part, maybe more hubris than confidence. I think it was the invincibility that we have in our youth, mm-hmm. that we feel.
Yes.
And it was more a matter of thinking I could forcefully overcome it with my by sheer personality or by stubborn perseverance. But I stayed with it, and I never thought I would not recover from schizophrenia,
right.
Even though, you know, it was more out of ignorance of the disease than anything, probably.
Right.
I didn't really understand what I was up against.
But when would you say things started to turn around and get better? I mean, did you sort of notice it was getting better, or was it a while before you realized that?
It actually got worse. Once I started taking the vitamins, when you put me on megavitamins, incidentally, this treatment is conjectured by Dr. Abram Hoffer, who died in 2008, but he proposed the adrenochrome theory for treating schizophrenia with megavitamins.
Mm-hmm.
And the hypothesis is that the megavitamins would displace adrenochrome, which is a metabolite of adrenaline.
Metabolite.
Yes. Thank you.
Anyways,
that was his proposition, and so it would take time to get rid of all this adrenochrome in my system. So I wasn't expecting instant results. I knew that, but
okay.
It did get much worse. Yeah.
And like, what when you say worse? Like, what was it? You just couldn't get out of bed, or what was your definition of worse?
Actually, the worst was I couldn't go outside. By this time, and remember, the night sky had changed. So it resembled nothing what I was used to. I can't begin to describe it, but it was completely warped and distorted. And now the daytime was affected too. So imagine if you stepped outside of your house and you noticed the buildings had changed their color and the trees had changed their shape or moved slightly. And then the next day, they all changed again. And that was the kind of thing I was up against. I could barely recognize my surroundings when I stepped outside. It didn't affect me indoors, but when I stepped outside, or I was even in like a department store or mall, things were radically distorted, and it was actually so deeply disturbing, I didn't even like to look outside.
Right, so you were pretty much stuck in. Were you unable to work?
Yeah, I had to quit my job because, well, fatigue overtook me too, so I had no energy. So I had just about everything. It was pretty well hit bottom. I had a girlfriend I had to break up with. I couldn't even hardly take care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't affected socially. My mind was still sharp, but obviously information, the world was the same. My mind was fine, but information was going through some kind of distortion filter and getting muddled up. And I was, as long as I could sort things out, which I did, I was fine. I was never delusional or paranoid or any of those things. I was able to sort it out, but these things did overwhelm me, of course.
Right. Okay, so when did you start to be able to go outside again and things started to gradually come back to better functioning?
Yeah. Actually, I'd like to go in more about other things that happened.
Sure.
Yeah, because this is important. You might think that schizophrenia is limited to hallucinations of the visual sort, but in fact, I was having hallucinating in all my senses. I would, for instance, on one time I'm lying in bed and I felt a stick in my hand, so real I had to look to make sure it wasn't.
Right.
And another time, and often I would smell perfumes, even though I was just in my house.
Right.
And I had, my taste was altered. So when I ate food, I didn't even recognize what I was reading.
Okay.
It was very strange to eat these things. I heard voices, but only like my name being whispered. No one told me to go kill anybody or anything like that.
Well, that's, thank goodness for small mercies, yes.
Yeah, and I had a whole slew of, a variety of things. Actually, I thought these were kind of amazing, actually, but I was better off without them. I once went, when I was homebound, I was really tired of being stuck indoors, so I decided to go for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And I went for a walk at night, which was probably the worst thing, because by then the nightscape was totally alien. I went out there and I could almost not function because it was so distorted, and my feet actually sunk into the cement. I could feel them sink in, and I could see it sink in, but the sidewalk was solid, because I actually walked back on it, and it was solid afterwards.
Right.
So I watched this. I watched my feet sink in, and then I got to a street lamp, and it was an extraordinary sight. This street lamp was giving off bands or rings of yellow and purple rings. They were expanding like ripples in a pond going outward, and it was just an amazing sight that just filled me with wonder. And I stood there gaping at it, and I realized anybody looking at me would think I was silly, but it was pretty startling. And then I walked to another light, and I watched it, and then I got scared, and I came back because it was a bit too much. I couldn't handle it. And fortunately, indoors, I didn't have those experiences. So eventually, I would peek out. I would look outside, and I would see that the outside was starting to appear normal, and that's when I knew I was getting better. And this was like maybe a couple years of taking megavitamin therapy, but I noticed as a first sign the outdoors was starting to appear normal.
And you know, presumably things gradually start to get back to normal. I presume that you eventually got a job. You started getting out and cycling. Like, how did it come back? Like, obviously not all at once. You didn't sort of walk out, get a job, get on your bicycle. What sort of came back first, and you know, how long did it take before you felt like you were in a much better place?
Yeah, it almost came back in reverse. The outside started to get normal. The hallucinations, which were occurring daily, started to peter out, and I got my energy back, mm-hmm. which was really important. I really missed having my energy to do stuff, because I tend to be restless. And then in 1982, and this is how many years, maybe after 7 years of taking mega vitamins, I had my last hallucination, and it was the only scary one I had. But I was actually cycling at the time. I was in Calgary, and I was cycling, hunched over, pedaling away, and my arms disappeared. And it shocked me so much that I actually screamed, because I thought, I'm just going to land on my face, and I got no arms to stop me.
Right.
And fortunately, my arms appeared, seconds later. Otherwise, I think I would have lost control.
I was telling some friends yesterday about the time when I was riding my mountain bike, and, on a mountain bike, you can ride over a curb quite easily, and for some reason, I only put one hand on the handlebars while I was doing this. That's not a good idea, because they swiveled around 180 degrees, and I ended up on the street. And I still, to this day, don't know what I was thinking at that time, but I can imagine if you felt both arms had disappeared, you'd be in really big trouble.
Yeah, I did go out with a bang with schizophrenia, I guess you could say. And, of course, the night sky eventually went normal, everything. Since 82, everything's been normal, no hallucinations.
Okay, so you
or distortion.
Go out at night and you just see stars and the moon.
Yeah, it's pretty boring now.
Well, as I told you earlier, last night I was up on top of a mountain because it was a full moon and we had a clear sky with stars and this huge full moon. And that was pretty awesome, even though we didn't have colored lights and things like that.
That's true. There's still lots to appreciate it at nighttime under unusual conditions. You're right about that.
Yes. This wasn't just any old night, but that was nature being crazy, not our brains. So gradually you started to work again, and you start to make relationships, things like that.
Yeah, everything went normal. I continued to take mega vitamins for a few years. I mean, I was worried about going back to where I was.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I can imagine.
And slowly I started to cut back. I started off with three grams. The main ingredient is vitamin B3. And I was taking 3 grams of that a day, plus 3 grams of vitamin C, plus a slew of B vitamins. Otherwise, you become deficient in the other B vitamins.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When that didn't work... When I got worse, Stajan put me on to 4 grams of B3 and 4 grams of C. And also, schizophrenics are known to be deficient in zinc, so I've taken zinc as well.
Right.
And I took other vitamins and some other things. I mean, at its height, I was actually taking 78 pills a day.
Wow.
And now
did
I'm,
you...
Yeah?
Yeah, did you make any changes to your diet or anything in conjunction? Like, did he advise you to eat differently?
No.
So pretty much continued.
Yeah. I was eating healthy at the time, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I always have. I've always been kind of health conscious.
Right.
But no, it was a matter of the vitamins. And I can't say for certainty if it played any kind of part, because some schizophrenics do fully recover. But I believe just because I started to turn around a few months after he increased the doses, I believe it had an effect on at least hastening the process.
Right.
If I was on the way back to recovering at the time.
And do you take any supplements of any kind now?
Not no more than anybody else. a few vitamins. Just
normal.
Yeah.
Interesting. You eventually married your wife. Did she have any role in this, or did you meet her after you'd sort of come back to normal?
Yeah, she came in years afterwards, yeah.
Oh, okay. So, oftentimes when people are struggling with their own mental or physical health, developing relationships, I mean, as you noted, was difficult, right? It's hard to maintain a girlfriend, wife, Even children, if your brain is melting down for various reasons.
Yeah, well, like I said, I had to break up with a girlfriend because I could hardly take care of myself. So it was maybe 3 years before I was able to get back into dating.
Right. You've researched schizophrenia yourself, and you have some ideas about what you think the causes are. So can we discuss that?
Yeah, the what's prevalent, or what seems what's indicative, is that there is genetic. There's a massive study done in Denmark at the University of Copenhagen, where they took over 31,000 pairs of twins, and they found that if one twin had schizophrenia, there's a 50% chance the other one would. So that indicated a genetic link. There's also a 6% chance that if a person has schizophrenia, then a first relative will have a 6% chance of getting it.
So one of the things about twins, like brothers and sisters, they tend to grow up in the same environment. Did they, for example, compare the twins to, like, siblings that weren't twins, like brothers and sisters?
Well, that's one thing. First degree relative, there's a 6% chance. I think with identical twins, it's about 50%, and then with
fraternal twins.
Yeah, it's about 10 or 20%
chance. Okay.
But they also said that 80% of the schizophrenic are genetic. In my case, there are no relatives in my family history that had schizophrenia. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. And also, there are people born with a genetic condition and it is with them for life.
Yeah.
Like Down syndrome is, it's not exactly a genetic condition in terms of mutation. It's caused by aneuploidy, but it's with you for life. There's no cure because you have an extra chromosome, and that's not going to change.
Yeah.
But in your case, schizophrenia came and then it went away. So do you have any ideas about why it can come and go within somebody's life?
None at all. None at all. And like I said, I can't even say for certain that megavitamins had an effect on my recovery. I like to think so, though. And from what I've seen, about 15 to 25% do fully recover. What is fortunate in my case is that I didn't take a single drug for it.
Right, which I guess at least, I mean, it doesn't prove too much, but it does say that at least in the psychological drugs are not necessary for 100% of people, because you're at least a counterexample.
Yeah, and like I said, these drugs can have side effects that continue even when you stop taking, like you can have permanent side effects from it. So I was at risk even if they did or didn't help, I was at risk for those. So I took no drugs whatsoever.
And I
have a lot to thank for Dr. Stajan Warnes for helping me.
Right. I mean, even if it would have gone away by itself, which you say is a possibility, even though you think it's less likely than that the vitamins helped, he gave you something to do or an approach to take other than the psychotropic drug approach.
Yeah, I am so thankful, because as I said, I was adamant in not taking any drugs, and I was so fortunate to find this doctor.
I also think, tell me what you think about this, that if you had gone on psychotropic drugs, I don't know how they would have said, oh, I think you're cured now, we can stop. I suspect you would have been on for the rest of your life.
That's true, although from what I've read recently is that they tried different ones. There's a slew of antipsychotic drugs, and they test you on each one to see which are effective, and then eventually they might be able to whittle it down to, you know, one at a lower dose and continue with that.
Right, but it's not likely they would stop entirely.
That's right. By far, most schizophrenics never fully recover.
Right. And, I mean, it would be difficult to know if you're recovered because, you know, weeks, I don't want to speak for you, but I assume that there were times where weeks would go by with no symptoms, and then they would come back.
Yeah, that's true. Especially at the beginning, where they're spaced apart by months, and then it became a daily thing. But like I said, I have had no episodes since 82.
So 1982. So we're out far enough. I mean, I guess you can never predict the future, but it seems probable that the symptoms at least are in the past. Now, do you still believe that you're schizophrenic, but you just aren't experiencing symptoms?
No, I don't believe that at all.
Yeah. So
I believe I'm fully recovered, and I have no worries about it coming back to me.
Yes.
Actually, most schizophrenia appears in the late teens and early 20s. Mm. So it's not likely to come up in your 70s or 60s or whatever.
Right. And I mean, it is unusual because it's one of the few. There aren't very many diseases that you can get that actually have positive benefits. I mean, it's very unusual in that respect that some of the side effects, and you've obviously said not all of them, are quite pleasurable, which is not true for most diseases I can think about.
That's true.
Like you think of cancer or depression, you can't really think of too many positives.
Yeah, or you know. Bipolar
right.
disease, and yeah,
right.
That's true.
That's really interesting. So
yeah, it's a mind-expanding experience.
Yes.
Not a mind-numbing experience.
I think the only time I've come close to this is the only time I've been close to hallucinating is I think I suffered when I traveled. I occasionally suffered from severe dehydration. And I would, in the middle of the night, start being half rational and half irrational. And I had this maybe two or three times before I figured out that it was dehydration, which can cause hallucinations. And it was not a very pleasant experience. It was actually a very unpleasant experience because I would think that I was dying in the middle of the night. And of course, you know, the other part of me is telling me I'm just imagining it. But when I realized it was just dehydration, I would just drink a few glasses of water and then I'd be fine again. But if you don't know what it is, if you don't know what the cure is, it can get worse and worse, and you could be misdiagnosed. Like, what if I'd gone to a doctor and had been diagnosed with a condition? I don't know.
Well, that certainly is key, is the understanding. Without the understanding, I don't know how I would decide. When I knew I was having hallucinations, I could tag them as quick as they came, and I was fine. I was fortunate not to become delusional, in that if I started to believe in my hallucinations and act on them, I'd be in serious trouble. But instead, I kept my frame of mind and weeded out these hallucinations continually and
right.
kept my awareness and my rationality.
Right, because you were aware that this was not normal. You weren't buying it.
But for a schizophrenia that doesn't understand that, especially when I started out, it was a bit scary, of course. But when you understand it, it goes a long way in helping you deal with it.
Okay, so before we get back to scrambling, is there anything else we should cover on schizophrenia or your history struggling with it?
No, I think we got it all.
So I guess one more question is you said it ended in 82. Like, when did it start? So how many years did you struggle with this?
Well, I started in my teens, so maybe, say, 18 to 32, so say 15 years.
15 years, yeah. Which is, in the context of your life now, it doesn't seem like so long, but 15 years is a long time to be.
And I wasn't incapacitated the whole time. I was seriously ill for maybe to the point where I couldn't work and stuff. Maybe 3 to 5 years. It really had an effect.
Right.
Like the apathy, the fatigue, and not being able to deal with the outdoors. Those are a those were a huge burden on me.
Right, which is ironic now because you spend a lot of time in the outdoors. And one thing that you do that I've never done, you describe, and I should say that this whole story is listed on your blog, so you've been pretty public about this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you've said is that you will be driving along and you'll see a mountain and think,
yeah,
I could get to the top of that. And that's something I've never done. I always follow a route that somebody has, that like you or somebody else has put in place. I haven't been doing this that long, so I don't really feel confident to look at a mountain and say, I think I could get to the top of that, even though nobody else has.
I guess that's the challenge for me. Is like a game of chess where you got to figure this out, and I really relish determining a route.
Right.
And nowadays you have so many tools at your disposal. You have Google Earth, so
right,
you can see it in the mountain in three dimensions. You got maps, you got GPS, and I really relish at doing those, although it's starting to get difficult to find peaks, even unnamed peaks, that can be done in a day that haven't already have routes going up them.
Right. And although it's so supposedly off trail, quite often you will find a distinct trail up the mountain just because so many people have gone up there.
I guess I can't explain it. I will tell you something that kind of set me off is my first important climb was Gap Peak. Now, Gap Peak was is in the first Gramble book by Alan Kane, and
mm-hmm.
he proposed a route that hikes several kilometers up the trail, climb Mount Fable, and then come several kilometers along the ridge and do Gap Peak and then drop on the side. Now, I had done Mount Fable, and I thought, why do I have to go? But I didn't do Gap Peak. So I'm thinking, why do I have to go all the way up this trail when Gap Peak is literally hanging over the roadside?
Right,
and
right.
Just go up there. And so I was determined to do it that way. It just seemed so bizarre. It didn't make sense. So anyways, I went up. I went up with my wife, Dinah, and we encountered a cliff band. And
mm-hmm.
we followed that cliff band for like an hour or more, and I thought, well, looking for a break.
Right.
Once we got above that, I thought we could do Gap Peak. So we couldn't find the break, so we came all the way back along the base of the cliff band, and that's when I realized, coming all the way back in the trees, there was a break. And the very next day, so it was by luck, really, I found a way
mm-hmm.
up. It wasn't by any special intuition. So the very next day, she and I and a couple friends went all the way up Gap Peak, and that has since become the standard route for Gap Peak.
Okay. Just because you were curious and figured there had to be.
But it certainly propelled me to study peaks and find a way up. It was the start of something I really enjoy doing, and that's route finding.
Right, and would you say that your sort of three-dimensional spatial sense is better than average? Like, I don't know if it's easy to rate that, but it seems like you think in three dimensions maybe better than most people who get confused looking at a map, let alone trying to understand the whole thing in three dimensions.
I could only hazard a guess, I guess, on that one. So
okay.
I assume so. I don't know. I don't know what's in other people's heads.
Right.
But I do know my website is popular for downloading GPS tracks, and people would rather do that than find their own way up.
I'm kind of in between. Like, I'd like to read the instructions, but usually I go out the instructions in my backpack and don't look at them, or, you know, if we get stuck, we'll get them out and look at them. But usually try to figure out ourselves, but I'm also know that somebody's been up there, so I know it's possible to do it.
Well, I find, yeah.
A friend recently asked me, when I would always be talking about, well, I was up this mountain or that mountain, or like
mm-hmm.
last night, you know, climbing a mountain in the dark so to see the full moon. She said, why? And I had to think about the reasons why I would do something like this. So if somebody asked you, why do you do this, like, what would your answer be?
Well, curiosity, adventure, excitement, the challenge. Ultimately, the challenge, I think. It's so satisfying to look at a peak and figure out a way up and get there and find that it works.
Right. Yeah, there's the that challenge, there's the exercise component, because it's a lot of work to go up usually around 1,000 meters from the ground level. I mean, I also enjoy those days, which aren't that many, where you can sit on top in the warm sun and the cool mountain air and like fall asleep or eat your lunch or something and just see the whole world seemingly at your feet.
Yeah, yeah. I get a big kick out of figuring routes up mountains.
That's your thing.
Yeah, that's my thing. But you know what? Over the nearly 20 years I've been doing this, there's slim pickings now in finding peaks either named or unnamed that
right.
you can do in a day, because between several books and websites, just about everything has been
done. Well, you're partly responsible for the dearth of untrammeled routes, because your website has described a lot of different routes, and like you say, you produce GPS tracks for people who just want to follow literally in your footsteps.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm glad I had the opportunity to be in that era, because that era is over. Anyone coming in now to the sport and they want to leave their mark by finding routes up new peaks, even unknown peaks, in one day, it's slim pickings.
Right. I mean, I think if you wanted to do that, you'd have to go somewhere else. Like, there's probably a lot of... I mean, Calgary's a city of a million, and there's a lot of outdoors-oriented people. So if somebody says you can go up Hawling, all of a sudden there's like 200 people a day going up Hawling,
yeah.
Probably the most popular scramble.
Yeah, the peaks in southern Alberta are pretty well taken for.
Right, right. So further north, places in British Columbia, I mean, there's probably also places in the U.S. where there's a lot of mountains around and not too many people, and those people could do the same thing.
Well, if you've been on my website, you know that I travel to Vegas a lot, and there are lots and lots of peaks, unnamed and named, that they're not documented, so it's a thrill to go down there and figure those out. And whenever I have a chance... Dine and I go down there and climb a peak.
Oh, okay. I was in Las Vegas, I think, 2 years ago, and for the first time I went hiking because I was so tired of being in the city itself, and really enjoyed it because it's much drier than around Calgary, so it's completely different. And I did come down the mountain on my own route, which was, for me, like I tend to like to... I've always liked to follow paths, so to sort of say, I think I can get down here, and there was a moment where I was pretty sure I couldn't, but I did make it down without any injuries or getting bitten by a rattlesnake or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, one thing about the desert peaks around Las Vegas is most of them have no trees, and it's easy to see a way through up and down these ridges.
Yes, yes, there's not a lot of vegetation for sure, and beautiful... sort of dry rivers, which I guess aren't dry all the time. You need to be careful down there after a thunderstorm, because they can fill up pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
For a short time, so you need to be careful. I mean, if people do want to come to southern Alberta to go scrambling, I guess there's books by Alan Kane and a guy named Nugara, which I think each have about 100 different routes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And then your website, bobsburko.ca, has some overlap, but very good descriptions, much better descriptions that are in the books, because the book will be one page, whereas if you printed out some of your descriptions, they'd be probably 10 pages.
Yeah, and I have the luxury of adding as many photos as I want, of landmarks to help a person find their way up a mountain.
Yes, which is much better than reading, right? When you can look at it and go, oh, that's that strange-looking peak. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be on my right, and it's on my left, so I've obviously gone the wrong way. I'd better figure out where I'm supposed to be. So to get back to the schizophrenia for a little bit, is one other question I had was that you have been very public. You've put your story on your website in quite some detail, again, as you like to do. It's several pages long.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of detail in there about your personal struggles. I mean, it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Have you had a lot of feedback from people?
Oh, yeah, I've had a few. I've had a few. They're all positive. They say things like it's an amazing story and you've lived an amazing life and things like that. And of course, I think some are influence people to think about other ways of dealing with illness and health adversity as well.
Well, I think there's hope that there can be a good outcome to what, you know, in your darkest days probably didn't seem like there was going to be one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good because it seems like there are more people struggling with a variety of what are called mental illnesses. I'm not sure that's quite the right word, but people dealing with an inability to function due to depression or delusions or, you know, many, many different things, PTSD,
yeah,
things like that. And so often it seems I think people get very fatalistic about it. It's like drug addiction. We know that people can get out of it, but when you see somebody in it, you kind of feel like they're never going to get out because it's been going on and on and on, and there's been no change, and you sort of conclude there never will be, but people can break out of these things.
Yeah, I thought it was important to get the message across because I don't think schizophrenics speak out about their experiences very much. At least I've never come across any accounts. So, and I certainly wanted people to know that it can be overcome naturally,
right,
one way or another.
Yes. Well, thank you for sharing your experiences with schizophrenia and scrambling with me today and with my audience. And I will send you a link to the MP3 when it's up.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
Yes, I did too, Bob. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening to episode 166 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.